Lecture 14, Rome of the Caesars as Superpower.
In our last lecture, we saw how Rome, by the first century BC, had become the absolute superpower of its day, dominant militarily, politically, economically, even culturally, for Rome was the heir of Greek civilization, and this Greco-Roman culture became the way of rising up in the social scale for people all over this vast empire. So it was a superpower, and it was trying to rule this empire with a constitution made for a small republic, and it collapsed. When people ask me where do I think America might stand on the scale of the Roman Empire, I say it has nothing to do at the moment with Rome of the 1st or 2nd century AD, Rome of the Caesars. It is Rome of the 1st century BC. The Roman Senate, which had provided such superb guidance for Rome during the struggle with Hannibal and the rise to superpower status, the Roman people, whose civic virtue and constitution, Polybius said, was the key factor in why Rome in one generation rose from being a small nation to being master of an empire, these began to crack under the weight of the wealth, the affluence, the political problems and complications brought about by empire. The Senate reached gridlock in the first century BC, and the partisan politics were so savage that neither party, the populares and the optimates, neither party could allow its compatriots, its rivals, to gain a political victory. So these problems just went unsolved. Pressing problems of social and economic needs, and above all, foreign policy issues. Moreover, at every critical moment when clear thinking was required, the Senate always found itself in some scandal, sex and religion scandals bubbling up from time to time, and setting up committees to investigate each other. This was their way out of these serious questions. And the result was the ordinary Roman citizen lost faith in republican freedom. They had already given up the desire to serve in their army and fight in these far-off wars, and now they wanted a leader who would give them prosperity and individual freedom and solve these political issues. But it would not be Pompey, we discussed in our last lecture. It would be Gaius Julius Caesar and his adopted son, known to history as Augustus. These would be the rulers who would solve Rome's problems and introduce 2 centuries of unparalleled peace and prosperity throughout the Mediterranean world and a good part of Western Europe and the Middle East. 2 of the most visionary statesmen in history, Julius Caesar, one of the greatest generals in history and a visionary politician, and Augustus, probably the most successful single statesman in all of history. And Julius Caesar had a vision. Pompey wanted to be the first man in Rome. He would be at home today in politics. He wanted to be in office. He wanted admiration. Caesar wanted to change things. He believed that Rome could no longer be a republic. The Roman people were not worthy of freedom. And they needed one man who could solve their problems and solve the problems of the empire. And so with foresight, vigor, with a desire and a goal to be king over this vast empire, Caesar, by 44 BC, had risen to supreme power at Rome, dictator for life. And he wanted one thing more. He wanted the title king. And Caesar pushed too far, too fast. He was assassinated. But his adopted son, who would be known to his contemporaries as Gaius Julius Caesar, his adopted son, Augustus, would know that people will not give up the shadow of freedom. And the Roman people still wanted to think of themselves as free. So in his long life, he died in bed peacefully, 77, at age of 77 in 14 AD, as absolute master of the world. All through his long life, Augustus kept coming up with little compromises, which left the facade of the old republican constitution, but gathered all real power into his hands. And he was the true founder of the Empire of the Caesars. Now, the founders of our country hoped that Rome of the Republic would be our model, but they feared that one day Rome of the Caesars would indeed become our model. And that Roman Empire of the 1st and 2nd century BC, that age of the Pax Romana, the immense majesty of the Roman Empire, is one of the most instructive lessons in history. Yes, the Roman people made a deal. They gave up the political freedom that they had enjoyed in order to have individual freedom and to remain a superpower. They could not be a superpower with a republican government, so they gave up their republic and became an empire, a military dictatorship of the Caesars. And the Romans would have told you, we made a good bargain. We got a very good bargain, for we now have the freedom to live as we choose, to raise our families, to rise far on the social scale, without all the silly political nonsense that goes on. That's why we have an emperor. And this was the Roman Empire of Augustus, of Nero, of Trajan, and Marcus Aurelius. The Roman Empire of the 1st and 2nd century BC. It stretched from Britain and the North Sea all the way out to the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley. It stretched all the way from Germany and the forest of that distant land to the sands of the Sahara. If you were going to go through the Roman Empire of today, you would start off in Britain. You'd come down to France, to Belgium and Holland, down through Western Germany, on into Switzerland and Austria, having passed through France, of course. You would go through Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, what we now call Croatia and Slovenia and Serbia, all at peace with one another, on down into Greece, through Turkey, through Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan. You would pass on into Egypt, through Libya, through Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and up into Spain. In other words, you would need a dozen languages to do this on your own. You'd need to get a series of visas. You would need to change your money time and time again, losing a little bit of money every step of the way. And there'd be places you would not want to go. Is that not true? Yes. But in the Roman Empire of the 1st and 2nd century AD, one language, Latin, if you had Greek, so much the better, but one language, Latin, would carry you anywhere in this empire. One coinage, the coinage of Rome, would carry you anywhere. And one law, the law of Rome, protected you all over this vast empire. For as a Roman citizen, you had not lost your individual rights, you had gained them. And the Roman citizen had a more clearly defined nexus of individual rights, including the freedom to speak, than he had had under the Roman Republic. The best display of this Roman freedom is St. Paul, the book of Acts, very historical. Paul has been taken prisoner by a tribune for causing a riot, and the tribune is about to give him a beating. And Paul says, you can't beat me without charges. And the tribune says, why? And he says, I'm a Roman citizen. And the tribune is astounded, asks that Paul show his papers, and then the tribune's terrified that Paul is going to bring him up on charges of violating his civil rights. That is the empire. It is crossed by a series of roads of the highest quality. We still travel over Roman roads today, where I used to do archaeological studies south of Rome. Every day I went to work over a Roman road. There are bridges in Rome that still carry traffic today that were built in 63 BC. So a superb network of roads, a sea that was kept clear of pirates and terrorism. It was guarded, these frontiers, this vast world, by a professional army of 360,000 soldiers. The best equipped professional army the world had ever seen. And for all of this, a free market economy that brought the goods of the whole world to you. Why, towns like Pompeii are Roman London. Towns that would become Vienna in Austria are towns like Leptis Magna in what is now a desert of Libya. These towns which were like a mosaic composing the Roman Empire, these towns had in their markets a display of goods like a modern supermarket, like a Walmart today. You could buy there in Leptis Magna, oysters brought from Britain, cloaks made in Gaul, pottery made in the north of Italy, silverware formed in Greece. Your wife could drag you to an interior decorator store. Your husband could drag you to an interior decorator store. And you would demand to redo your whole house in marble. That marble could be cut all over the empire, depending on your fancy, and shipped to you and be in your house in a few weeks. An economic unity that would not exist again until our own day. Now, it was an age of social mobility in which men were born slaves, they bought their freedom, and they would rise to be multimillionaires. Now, their sons could go on to lives in the Roman civil service, and their grandsons could become senators even. And the army provided a means for social mobility. But the Roman army was divided in half. 180,000 of its troops were Roman citizens. The other 180,000 were drawn from various people of the empire who did not have Roman citizenship yet. And by serving in the army for 25 years, they then became Roman citizens. And their children became Roman citizens. So the language of Rome, the benefits of Roman civilization, they spread throughout this empire to such a degree that by the year 212 AD, every freeborn inhabitant of the Roman Empire became a citizen. It truly was, as one of its admirers said, a city that had become an entire world, bringing everybody to its benefits. It was a tolerant empire, and Roman emperors built temples to the gods of Gaul, to the Egyptian gods. In fact, many of the temples you see as you go up the Nile today were erected or restored by Roman emperors. Roman emperors were regarded as pharaohs over Egypt. It was a religion, an age of religiosity, an age of spiritual seeking all over this vast empire, as it was indeed an age of creativity. Now, yes, democracy and political freedom can spawn creativity. We live in one of the most creative ages in history, I believe, because more people are free today and have political freedom than any other time in history. But the Roman Empire of the Caesars was a tremendously creative age. It was the age in which, in science, the foundations of the next 1,000 years of European civilization were laid. It was the age in which Galen wrote his textbooks, which would still be the medical textbooks of Europe in the 15th century AD. And it was the age of Ptolemy, the 2nd century AD in Egypt. Ptolemy laid out latitudes and longitudes, drew a map of the world. You say, what does Ptolemy have to do with me living here in the 21st century? Well, that map was still the standard map in Europe in 1492. And studying that map, Christopher Columbus was taken by one of the actual mistakes of Ptolemy. Ptolemy had shown that China was much closer to Europe than it really was. And Columbus, believing in that map, thought if he could sail westward, he would come to China. And instead, he found a whole new world. It was an age in which, in architecture, the foundations for the next century, next 1,000 years were laid. The Pantheon, designed by the Emperor Hadrian and erected between 119 and 138 AD. This Pantheon laid the intellectual as well as constructional techniques of the Gothic Cathedral. It was meant to be a spiritual experience. You go inside the Pantheon and your soul is swept up into eternal union with God. And in art, the Column of Trajan that he had designed to celebrate his victories over the Dacians, this Column of Trajan portrayed campaign after campaign in a spiral of narrative reliefs. And those narrative reliefs, the use of these visual forms to convey the message of imperial victory, then became the basis of the Christian mosaics that would decorate the churches of 4th and 5th century Rome, and then of Byzantium itself. So in art, in architecture, in medicine, in science, and it was in this very age that Christianity would spread all over this vast empire. And Paul, as a Roman citizen, would travel through this empire in safety because of the peace that had been brought. In fact, the early church fathers believed that it had been the will of God to send a Messiah to the world in the age of Augustus so that there would be the peace to spread the gospel all over the world. And it was an age of law. And in the 1st and 2nd century A.D., going on down into the 3rd century A.D., the foundations of Roman law were laid in the great jurist of the age, like Ulpian. And that law would then go on to be the legal basis for more than half the world still today. Roman law was the basis of the law codes of France, of Germany, of Italy, of Latin America. It even played a role in shaping the law codes of Japan. This magnificent achievement. And the Romans were also a people who grew into their imperial destiny. The poet Virgil, writing under Augustus, created his Aeneid to proclaim that the gods themselves had chosen Rome. And in it, he portrays the mission of the Romans. Other people will make better sculpture than you. Other people will give better orations than you, Romans. You, Romans, have as your duty to war down the haughty and to raise up the weak, to conquer the arrogant and to raise up the weak. You, Romans, will bring law and peace to the world. That is your mission. And that is how the Romans came to see themselves. The Roman imperial system brought forth a set of leaders of ability and dedication with few parallels in history. Augustus, who shaped this empire, and it has been truly said of Augustus that only two times in history has a very serious problem been solved as well as it possibly could be. Once was with the founders of our country, and the other was with Augustus. Claudius. He seemed a little strange to some of his fellow Romans. He was a scholar who learned Etruscan, but he conquered Britain. And he began a series of administrative changes which would create one of the best civil services of its day. The civil service of the Roman Empire in the 1st and 2nd century AD reached a marvelous equilibrium, large enough to carry out the duties of governing this empire, but efficient, filled with civil servants who saw their mission as to bring peace and order to the world, and governing the empire with such regularity that strange emperors like a Nero or Domitian were nothing more than a blip upon the stage of history. So peace, order, tolerance. It was a multicultural, diverse empire. The Romans did not force you to learn Latin or Greek. You could plead your case in court, in Gaul, in Celtic. You could plead it in Carthage, in the ancient Punic language. You could plead it in Syria, in the Syriac language that Jesus spoke. So multicultural, diverse, allowing people to worship whatever gods they worshiped. As long as they were Roman citizens, they also had to worship the gods of Rome. But other than that, you were free to worship as you chose. The Roman Empire of the 1st and 2nd century AD was also expansionistic. And Roman emperors like Claudius conquered Britain, and the Emperor Trajan carried out a long and successful war to reduce the Dacians of what is now Romania, bringing back massive amounts of money to spur the economy of Rome. It was also an age of philanthropy. And many of the monuments you see throughout the Roman world today and the ruins were given by civically minded Roman citizens who had been successful in this empire, made a lot of money, and now wanted to build an aqueduct for their city, to build baths for their cities, to build a gymnasium where people could be healthy, to build schools. For it was an age of professors and commentators on the great classics of the past, chairs that were sponsored by the emperors themselves. An age of philanthropy and an age of a free market economy. And to have all of these benefits, to have a free market economy in which you could go down to your local bank and get 6% on a CD. Now, I don't think that's bad. Or if you were more of a speculator, you could join a joint stock operation, make a merchant venture, and maybe come back with 12 times what you had invested. Now, you might lose everything, but you could come back with 12 times what you had made. For all of this benefit, the peace and prosperity of the Roman Empire, this network of roads, you worked 2 days a year to pay your taxes. Because the Roman emperors understood that if you leave money with people, they will then invest it and the economy will continue to grow. It was an age in which all important decisions were made at the very top by the emperor and by his advisors. But politics were very decentralized. And when we study the inscriptions from cities like Pompeii, we see that the local political life was extremely active. People were very interested in what happened in their own little city and in what their taxes were going to be in their own local city, whether a new bath structure, a new fitness facility was erected. So decentralized, very avid politics at the local level, but major decisions made at the imperial level. So great was the peace and prosperity of this empire that the Roman historian Tacitus, writing in the 2nd century AD, complained that unlike those who wrote about the history of the Republic, he had nothing but boring things to tell you because there were no grand wars and grand events. That is the happiest kind of age for ordinary people. Edward Gibbon would describe this age as the happiest in human history. This age of the 1st and 2nd century AD, when this vast empire was ruled by firm and efficient emperors, where individual liberty flourished, and where creativity in art, in literature, set standards for Gibbon's own age, the happiest in human history. So the Romans would have told you that they had made a good bargain when they had given up their political liberty to raise their nation to new heights and to achieve a new level of individual freedom. There were still problems. There were foreign policy problems that remained difficult for the Roman emperors to resolve. There was the Near East, the Middle East, and to that we will devote an entire lecture. And there were the frontiers of the Roman Empire. There was above all the vast land across the Rhine and Danube rivers, inhabited by fiercely independent tribes, the Germans, once the Dacians, the Sarmatians, fiercely independent, divided, but always capable of coming together in unified action. Now, the Emperor Augustus had been a very careful and shrewd judge of how far the empire could expand. He had tested the waters first in the Near East, where he had come to an understanding with the Empire of Iran, and he had tested the waters in Germany as well. In 9 AD, it seemed as though the whole of the German tribes could be conquered, and the Romans would expand and even annex Germania. So confident was Augustus that the civilian officer Varus was put in charge of 3 legions to march into Germany to complete the reorder, the pacification of the Germanic tribes. And there he encountered the German war chief Arminius, Hermann the German. And in the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, all three legions were destroyed, and the Roman army would stop at the Rhine River. "Give me back my legions," Augustus would say as he walked the halls, an old man. "Varus, Varus, give me back my legions." But he learned from that warning. And the Romans came to understand that there was no purpose in expanding deep into Germany, to an endless land of forest and then steppes that went all the way out to Russia and even to Central Asia. So the limits of expansion and the wisdom of moderation. In the south, in Africa, there were forays into the Sahara, and was there any need to press deep into what we would call the Sudan today? And once again, this wisest of statesmen, Augustus, decided no, there had to be a limit there, what the Romans called the limes, the frontiers. So he set limits in the Middle East. He set limits along the northern border, what we would call Central Europe, and he set limits in the Sahara and in the south. So a moderation in terms of imperial expansion. Augustus Caesar, he had been born Gaius Octavius, the great nephew of Julius Caesar. Caesar knew him very little, but he had impressed the great general. Young Gaius Octavius was going out to be with his uncle in Spain. His boat had been shipwrecked, and he made his way there on his own. And to his amazement, when Caesar was assassinated, this young Octavius had been designated as the heir of Julius Caesar. And he was at the age of 19 on a junior year abroad studying in Greece. And he made his way back, using the name of Caesar and his adopted form of Gaius Julius Caesar. He would raise an army on his own accord. He would punish and see to the death of those who had assassinated Caesar. He would make alliances and then break them with Mark Antony. And by the year 31 BC, he had risen to supreme power over the Roman world. But it was a world in chaos. It was a world in economic disaster. It was a world in which the provincials wanted to break away from the Roman Empire. It was a world in which the Roman people themselves had become utterly disenchanted. And he set about to create this system that we have been describing, step by step. 27 BC, he came before the Roman Senate and announced simply, "I have had enough. I am retiring from political life. I have restored the republic. You now have your constitutional system back. Do with it what you can. But you have peace. Come up with a means to govern the provinces well. Come up with a means to have economic prosperity. But leave me out of it." Well, of course, the Senate had been very carefully organized to demonstrate against this, to beg him to stay on, so he kept a few powers. And over the years, they grew ever larger. But he was, in fact, absolute master of the army. And the new name he took, Imperator Caesar Divi Filius Augustus, the conquering general, Caesar, the son of God, Augustus, the Messiah. The first word of an imperator expressed his absolute domination of the army. As Caesar, he continued the vision of Caesar, of the Roman Empire under an absolute ruler, bringing peace and prosperity to all. And Divi Filius, not blasphemy to the Romans at all, but literally the son of the deified Caesar who had risen to the stars. And Augustus, carefully chosen. And the best rendition of it is indeed the Messiah. And all over the empire, he was hailed as the Prince of Peace, the Savior of the human race. So this one statesman, Augustus, through his wisdom, his prudence in domestic and foreign policy, but above all his patriotism, for he was a genuine patriot who believed that the best interest of Rome could only be served by this military dictatorship. And he sugared the pill so well that the Roman people gulped it down. That one statesman created this model empire, this model superpower.